Welcome to the first episode of the World in a Satin Bag novel podcast. A quick note, I'm not going to do this every podcast, but I don't want on the first episode to have a good introduction of what this is all about. The World in a Satin Bag was a novel I started in 2006 as an experiment. I wanted to do a blog, and I thought what a great way to keep active was to write a novel. Finished the novel, I set it aside, thought I'd never come back to it again. It was just kind of whatever, right? Well, I came into some fairly recent financial issues. I have lizards, and one of those lizards has had health complications for a number of years. And essentially, the bills recently have become really expensive. He's on 5 medications, and I'm trying to basically make sure that he keeps his eyeball. So I decided, what is a better catalyst than financial strife than to do something radical, crazy, for me anyway? And I'm going to do this, which is I'm going to edit this novel that I wrote, seriously edit it, rewrite it, and then podcast it, and then release it as an ebook. And during that process, I want to do something very special, which is I want to hopefully get donations, which will essentially make it so I can live through July, and hopefully most of June. The object is to reach a $1,000 goal. That's a very big goal. I know it's a big goal. I think the novel's worth it, and I hope that you'll donate. I'm actually going to sweeten the pot. You won't just get the novel, though. I've decided that if I reach certain milestones in that funding, I will actually write and provide new stories set in the same world as the World in the Satin Bag. Those will be short stories. They'll be of various lengths. They'll be longer than flash fiction. I will also podcast those. And the funding goals are basically at every $250, I will write a new story and podcast it. That is an infinite. Even though my goal is $1,000, if we happen to hit $2 billion, we're not going to hit that, but I, just for the sake of the example, I will continue writing one every $250, period, for as long as I receive donations for this. It's a huge goal, and I know it's really, really, like, there's not a lot of time, but I'm hoping you will consider donating, and at the very least, letting me know what you think about this, about the novel, about my podcasting, this, everything. So, easy things to just, if you want to email me, it's arconna@yahoo.com. That is also the same address you can send PayPal donations, or you can go to my blog at wisb.blogspot.com. which is my personal blog. There will also be links for donations there on the sidebar, and all sorts of fun stuff. And you can obviously leave a comment on one of the episodes, wherever you happen to have found it, and I'd love to hear from you. So thank you for sort of dealing with my first 3 minutes of nonsense. And now I'm going to give you the very first chapter. Chapter 1, Hanser Manor. James Fortright craned his neck, his eyes tilted upward and his brow curved in concentration. Before him stood the one place he didn't want to be this night, the Hanser grounds. The place appeared so like the Ghost Haven, his classmates had said, even if he didn't believe in such things. A raggedy school clutched the earth, crumbling and surrounded by shards of glass and covered in snow. Nearby, a rusted playground lay bent where tree branches had once fallen on the bars. The old chains of the swing cried out in the night, and a single street lamp sent long shadows over the grounds. James pulled his coat tighter around him. But it wasn't the playground or the school that frightened him. It was Hanser Manor. The monstrosity reached 3 stories, and unlike other houses in the small town of Woodton, it looked like a relic from a time that never existed. At least, not for anyone that had ever lived in the town. From the front, Hanser looked like a massive church. A tall, stained-glass window filled the space above the door, which had been boarded up and covered in condemned signs, while the sides curved up into a giant point. At the top of that point rested a twisted weather vane that at one time had been the form of a snake. Now, after many years of abuse, it had contorted into an unrecognizable scrap of metal. The rest of Hanser stretched 100 feet back. A giant cigar made of pale gray stone, faint whispers of golden paint in its crevices. James focused on the stained glass as if he hoped to see something there in the bland, featureless colors. But the glass was blank except for the brilliant red and purple colors. They were oddities on the grounds, brilliant even in the dim light of cloudy night. He spied the clouds above the manor and knew from the dark gray clouds rolling in from beyond that another snowstorm was coming. Even then, he knew, those windows would shine. A swift wind flung snow and ice-cold air into his face. He shifted his weight, tucked himself farther into his winter jacket, and pulled the festive blue and green cap down over his ears and dark brown hair. If he had known better, he might have been at home, tucked into bed like most every other 13-year-old in Woodton. His eyes were immediately drawn back to the reds and blues and yellows. "I think there's something wrong with those windows," came a familiar voice, interrupting him. He turned, faced Laura, and smiled, a half-smile, weak with cold and uncertainty. "I always feel like the builders left something out, left it unfinished or something." He nodded. "So what was this you wanted to show me?" She beamed up at him. He was a good foot taller than her, but she was always able to look him in the eye without standing on her toes. Strands of blonde hair fluttered in the wind under her emerald-green fleece cap with a red and black stripe along the rim. "Overheard Gil talking about some neat stuff he found there," she indicated the manor. "Figure we should take a look. That's breaking and entering. Only if we get caught. Besides, we'll only be a minute." Laura skipped toward the manor, peering back and grinning as if to egg him on. An electric lamp came awake in her hands, illuminating the pale features of the manor. James followed her with his eyes, frowning. They had been friends for longer than he could remember, a friendship of opposites. Laura the adventurous type, and James the less likely to get involved type. Yet James recalled, it was always adventure that won the argument, never the logic of staying at home and following the rules. It always seemed to James like a strange twist of fate that he had befriended someone such as Laura, but he enjoyed her company nonetheless. He looked to see if anyone was following, twisting around in quick, jerky motions. Then, slowly, deliberately, with the resolve of an animal giving in to its fate, he followed Laura, one snow-crunching step at a time. Laura hopped left, then right, digging her green boots into the snow. The lamp bobbed with her, creating faces on the walls like a jack-o'-lantern. Then James was at her side, and together they wound around the side of the manor, Laura bouncing about with mischief in her eyes. James eyed the boarded windows and doors, covered in condemned signs. The stained-glass windows were all but forgotten in the dark shadows of the manor. As far as he could remember, Hanser Manor had always been condemned. Always. James gathered that the owners didn't care about the place, but he didn't know who currently owned the grounds or the manor. There had been a story in the local paper that said the place had been passed down from father to son 3 times, but they weren't the original owners. Just as the 4 private parties that had traded ownership back and forth before them weren't. Nobody even knew who had built it. Something tickled the back of his neck, a creepy feeling he had had more than once before when he was with Laura. He tried to ignore it, but even as they wound the corner to the back of the manor, the tickling plagued him, sending the hairs on the back of his neck at full salute. Around the back, they discovered a broken window. Snow sloped smoothly to the edge, offering easy access to the interior like a weathery welcoming mat. The wood that had blocked this window had been snapped in half and torn from their nails, and then chucked aside to be partially buried by the snow. The jagged edges stuck out from the white like wicked fingers. "Careful of the edges," Laura said, scurrying up the slope with ease. She grabbed the side of the window and slipped smoothly through the opening. James crept up to the edge, following Laura's light. He kneeled to maneuver himself feet first through the window. With one hand supporting his weight against the snow and the other on the outside of the window, he reached for solid ground, and kept reaching farther and farther, his toes wiggling in his boots as he searched desperately for solid floor. But he couldn't find it, and his fingers slipped from the frame, slick from snow. His other hand followed suit, and he tumbled through, tearing his jacket on the jagged remnants of glass and scraping his knee on the floor. He landed with a squishy thud. "Ow!" A small trickle of blood fell from his fresh wounds. He clasped a hand over a long cut on his arm. Laura leaned in close, her brow lifted, curious like a cat's. "That must have hurt." "Let's go home. I need a bandage for this." James bit his lip in frustration before pulling himself up, wincing. A small river of blood leaked through the cracks of his fingers. He watched a few drops fall to the floor. "I might need stitches for this." Laura frowned. "All right, fine. Can we at least look around for a second?" She turned away, snatching something from a nearby table. "Here." A blood-red cloth dangled from Laura's hand, and a warm smile adorned her face. She brushed aside his bloodied hand, wrapped a cloth tight over the wound, and tied a knot. A jolt of pain ran up his arm. "Just for a minute, honest. Besides, it's not deep enough for stitches." She looked at him, and he knew from the way her eyes chastised him that it was a motherly look, and he was the child. James sighed and gave in. "So be it, but not too long." She grinned appreciatively and leapt to her feet. "Come on." James took in his surroundings. Laura had set up her lamp in the middle of the room and twisted the knob to its highest setting. Shadows still dominated the room, shivering at their points like old man fingers. They had landed in a bedroom. Someone had left the place furnished. Thick mats of dust covered everything from the dressers to the bed, its sheets stained yellow with age and its faded quilt tucked tight and straight. A long cherrywood dresser loomed in the corner. James examined the pictures on the walls. They were old, ancient even, black and white and fuzzy. All the faces were grim and dull, not a smile among them, as if they had been forced to stand there all day for that single tiny picture. He didn't recognize the faces, but somehow thought they might be in a book someplace. When he got home, he thought, he would look them up and see if they were in the town's online registry. Despite what others thought of him, James loved a good mystery, so long as he could solve it from the safety of his house. Laura had already begun fumbling with the little additions to the room, statues, music boxes, a little trinkets that others who had come into the manor had left behind. She opened the dresser drawers, poked and prodded the dusty clothing inside, and then moved on. Every time Laura moved something, dust exploded into the air, raining down everywhere like ashen snow. James kept his hands to himself. He moved around the room, examining things by sight. He got the feeling that the pictures were watching him, as if the little people inside were real. The hair on his neck wriggled, struggling to spring free from their fleshy prison, drawn into action by something otherwise. He couldn't wrestle the strange tingling away, even with a brush of his hand. Then an eerie cold swept along his neck, stronger than before, like fingers delicately playing with his skin. He whirled around again, but aside from he and Laura, the room was empty. When he faced the pictures again, they were still as statues, held forever in the picture frames with dark eyes flat and unmoving. He shook his head and did his best to ignore the ill feeling of his skin. Soon he was alongside Laura, examining the dust-ridden items resting on top that she had left alone. There were strange statues of animals and people, pictures and strips of cloth embroidered with intricate patterns. He noticed that blood had already seeped through the cloth covering his wound, leaving a darker red stain on the already blood-red cloth. But it wasn't the blood that interested him. It too had been embroidered with a pattern, a set of four tails of some sort of sea animal woven together into a spiral. It was a symbol he recognized in some deep place of his memory. "Laura, come look at this," he said. Laura hustled over, hopping again. "Well, that's a neat design," she said. "It's Celtic, St. Brendan's cross." "St. Brendan?" "He was an Irish monk, spent 7 years at sea to find a place called the Land of Promise, at least according to legend. Some say the place he discovered was America." "People believe silly things," he nodded. "But look at all these. They all have Celtic symbols on them." He began flipping through the other cloths. "Here's a Celtic weave," he said, pointing to a design of interlocking curves that spanned all four sides. Leafing through, he found more designs, all sewn into the fabric. They had been done by hand, thread by thread, and they were well done. He could tell that they were the work of someone with considerable skill. "What about this one?" Laura produced a small bag made of dark red satin with a golden drawstring around the opening. The string was pulled taut and tied in a thick knot. In the center of the bag was a large symbol sewn in dark blue. The outside edges formed a wide circle broken in four parts, while inside, divided in fours, were triangles, the lines woven unicursally, curling in and out of each section. The design glistened in the light like oil in the sun. "That's a shield knot. How do you know all this junk? I read a lot." "So that's what you do in your free time?" James glared. "Yes, that's what I do in my free time," Laura snickered. "Shield knots were used for protection or warding." "There's something heavy inside." "What do you mean? The bag is empty." He squeezed the bottom to demonstrate. "Hold it and tell me it's empty." James took the bag. Indeed, it was heavier than expected, and gravity surprised him when the bag dragged his arm down. It had to be several pounds at least, if not more. James had used bowling balls of a similar weight. He stared at the bag, bewildered, squeezing the bottom to see if anything was inside. But the bag was empty, completely. "See? It makes no sense." "No," Laura crossed her arms. "Maybe there's some sort of metal inside. Something really dense. Didn't we go over something like that in class with Mr. Simon?" James pursed his lips, and all the time he spent reading, he couldn't recall anything that would make a small satin bag the weight of a bowling ball. Nothing legal, anyway, and certainly nothing Mr. Simon would have brought up in class. He shook his head. "Then we should see what's inside," Laura said. "Maybe it's something amazing and new, a meteor made of strange interstellar metals." "I don't know," James said. "It might be dangerous." Laura frowned and snatched the bag from him. He protested, but she ignored him and began to untie the drawstring, fiddling for a long moment before biting at the knot. After a short burst of grumbles and curses, she managed to get it untied. James looked on apprehensively, but he couldn't contain his excitement as Laura loosened the drawstring and pried the bag open. Laura's face transformed, moving through slow transitions from excited to disappointment. Her lips formed a thin line and her eyes grew narrow. James felt his own grin sliding away. He had hoped there would be something truly special inside, but there was no mistaking Laura's sunken face. "It's empty," she said. "Look." She leaned the bag in his direction. He leaned over and peered closely into the bag. The inside was abnormally dark. None of the light from the room or outside seemed to penetrate inside, nothing but black. He blinked and rubbed his eyes. But when he was about to turn away, he saw it shining in the bag, rising from nothing like a predator in shadows. There in the darkness was an eye, peering up at him wide and bloodshot. The iris gleamed icy blue, and little streaks of crimson pigment framed the snake-like slit that filled in for a pupil. And then the eye blinked at him. James screamed, stumbling backwards and landing hard on his bottom. "There's an eye!" Laura cocked her head to the side. "Inside the bag. Look! An eye! What are you babbling about?" "Just look!" James shivered after Laura snatched the bag from his hand, the eye vivid in his memory. Laura pulled the bag open and stared. At first, she curled away in disgust once more, now more with James than with the bag. Her eyes darted to him, and he avoided her gaze. Then her face went blank, and her eyes quivered. James heard something soft, unintelligible, like whispers. He tried to focus, but couldn't make out the words. Laura's lips remained still. "Laura?" No answer. Her face shivered, and a bead of sweat rolled from her forehead, down her lip, and then to the floor. "Laura, answer me!" The whispers grew stronger now, hissing words he didn't understand. The words weren't English, nor any language he had ever heard before. They were guttural and thick with syllables. Something seemed sinister about them, and that strange feeling along his neck became an urgent, fleshy clawing. He flinched, but the invisible fingers remained. "Laura!" His voice cracked, desperate. But she still would not answer, and sweat rolled down her face in droplets by the dozens, her whole body shaking. His heart raced. He stepped forwards, took her by the shoulders, shook her, called her name, and even tried to drag her to the window, but to no avail. Then the whispers stopped. The satin bag shook, rippling like the ocean. A faint light pierced the opening. It grew brighter and brighter, until there were no shadows left on Laura's face. The light intensified, glowing with amber hues. And then fire poured from the bag in two serpentine forms, shrieking like a dying animal in the night. The flames licked the walls and ceiling before circling Laura in their coils. In moments, Laura had been engulfed, the two fire serpents tasting the air. James knew they were searching for him, and when they saw him standing there, terrified and shaking and alone, the flames struck the ceiling, crackling in the air before descending upon him. He raised his arm, instinct consuming him in that desperate moment. Through the corner of his eye, he saw Laura disappear in the intensity of the blaze. He knew then that she was gone. The fire serpents struck James from above, their flowing forms scorching the ceiling and the floor and everywhere else they touched. The force knocked him from his feet, and he landed hard, striking his head against something wooden. His sight blurred, even as they came for him again, and in those last moments he remembered three things. A flash of blood-orange light accompanied by the roar of a great bird, the flames crying out and receding into the bag, and a burnt, black circle where Laura had once stood. That's the end of Chapter 1. I will have Chapter 2 hopefully tomorrow or the day after. The plan is every day, but if you enjoy the episode, please let me know if you like the story, if you have any issues, whatever, just let me know. So look forward to hearing from you. Thank you again for listening. Bye-bye.